A proud supporter of this program, Riverbend Food Bank's vision is a hunger-free Iowa and Illinois.
Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory has been serving Quad City families since 1889. Whelan Presley Funeral Homes are located in Rock Island, Milan, and Reynolds and are proud supporters of WQPT.
Are we spiking, surging, falling, or over-worrying? The COVID-19 statistics from a person in charge of our public health every day, plus blood and antibodies, what some people are giving to stave off COVID-19 in the cities. The cities ended the month of June with some spikes in COVID-19 cases. Since then, we've seen falling numbers in Rock Island and Scott counties, but nothing like the low levels of positive cases from a week ago. Medical experts say it's not a case of extra testing. We talked about that with infectious disease specialist Dr. Lewis Katz, who's also the medical director of the Scott County Health Department. Dr. Katz, I mean, you were really worried last week about what the numbers that you were seeing in Scott County and throughout the Quad Cities. What's changed in the last week?
It's gotten worse.
How so?
We're seeing more cases.
You've been very worried in particular, especially among the youth.
Well, yeah, as you know, and as I said repeatedly in May, we were reopening too soon. And this ain't rocket science. Every infectious disease doc and epidemiologist in the country said, slow down. Political pressures were yielded to. And now we never got out of the first wave. This is a surge inside the first wave. And in large areas of the country, anything that was gained with the pain in March through June has been lost.
It's almost human nature, though, isn't it?
That people thought that they was.
It's almost human nature, though, that people thought, "Oh, we're out of the woods. We're going to go out again." I mean, you kind of had a feeling this was going to happen, didn't you?
Well, I said so in print. It's not human nature. It's ignorance and bad political leadership.
When you're looking at the numbers now,
not human nature at all. Had people gotten a consistent message from the entire hierarchy of our government, from the level of the state on up, I think things could have been different. Certainly, they have been. Everywhere else in the world, with the exception, I suppose, of places like Brazil, a few others in the developed world, this was preventable.
Now, as you really did point out, was that this isn't like a second wave. This isn't a second, you know, a portion of this. We're still in that first wave of COVID-19.
Yeah, we never had it controlled in the United States.
What is controlled then?
20,000 cases a day in May and June was not controlled.
What would be controlled?
Less, lots less. Look at the European curve compared to the U.S. curve. That's what control looks like.
Now, you made it very clear that the increase in number of cases in the Quad City area is not due to increased testing, which some people say it is.
They're wrong. The main epidemic curve that I use, that we use at the health department, is not positive tests. It's symptomatic cases. And that's not testing artifact. That's sick people. We're now starting to see increases in hospitalizations, which is a lagging indicator by 7 to 14 days after case reports start coming in. Then 7 to 10 or 7 to 14 days later, you get hospitalizations. And in the 7 days or so after that, you start to see people winding up in the intensive care units. We're very hopeful that it won't be as bad during this surge because of the number of younger people who are being infected, which is far greater now than it was in March and April and May. But when they start transmitting to older people and high-risk people, there's a possibility that will change, and we'll start stressing the healthcare system again.
Everybody said
it was all preventable.
The Scott County Health Department was pointing out that they have gotten reports of a number of establishments, bars, where their patrons were shoulder to shoulder. There are workplaces that have told people, okay, you may have tested positive, but still come into work. It really does bother Ed Rivers. I'd assume it bothers you just as much.
Yeah. I mean, it's assault with a deadly weapon, right? This virus kills people, and we have people acting irresponsibly and claiming it's their constitutional right to do so. You have a right to carry a gun, not to shoot somebody with it. These people are shooting others with the virus.
You had said last week that you really thought that what is going on right now, this little extra spike and surge that you're seeing right now, really jeopardizes, as you said, everything that was done in the months before, but also jeopardizes a healthy economy. In other words, we're hurting ourselves now more than if we were just to keep following the rules.
Had we tamped things down into July and August and been able to ramp up testing and contact tracing appropriately, we could have kept things at a low level. Our contact tracers at the health department are having trouble keeping up now, and we're discussing with the state whether they have any aid to give us, but we'll see this weekend whether we manage to keep up with the case reports. But yeah, we've lost anything that was accomplished with all the misery of March, April, and May, and we're basically appear to be back to square one. It's absolutely no secret that I wanted the lockdown to continue longer until we were able to have in place everything that we need, and we don't, and so now we pay the price.
Tell me about the problems that you see with the contact tracing right now, because health department workers have been trying to contact people who were infected to get information, to find out if you can trace it back to other people and trace it forward to other people. And people just aren't answering the phones?
Oh, no. It's the volume. People generally cooperate with us. That has not been the case everywhere in the country. There are anecdotes about refusals to cooperate with contact tracing. We manage to reach almost everybody. That's not the issue. It's how many people does it take to reach everybody when you're seeing 30 to 40 new cases every day. The interviews, it takes time to find the people. The interviews take time. Then we have to reach out to the recognized contacts. This is incredibly labor intensive. There are estimates that were made in May and June that if we had to have nationwide robust contact tracing required 150 to 200,000 additional public health personnel to do that work. That's a big number, and I thought it was too high. But those are the kind of estimates that you see. We are repurposing people who have other jobs at the health department to do this, while at the same time trying to continue things like swimming pool inspections, restaurant inspections, environmental inspections, lead, sexually transmitted diseases clinics. We're backing off on our usual tasks in order to do contact tracing. But it's incredibly labor intensive. People are working 7 days a week, and it's difficult to maintain at the level that we want, which is to get to people immediately once we've got a positive test result.
Health department is also working hand in hand with school districts all throughout the area, because that's one of the biggest issues that are facing us as we head into the fall is getting kids back into school, if they go to school at all or if they continue remote learning. Tell me what's going on as far as Scott County is concerned, as far as the reopening of schools and the health department's involvement.
Well, we are working with the Area Education Agency, so it's bigger than just Scott County. We have several sets of guidelines, and we're adapting them to our needs. My concern, these kids need to be in school for dozens of reasons, not just education, but parents need to be able to go to work. So if you want the economy to come back, we have to get the schools open safely, and we're working on that. We're working in an area where the data on the role of school-age children in transmission is being worked out, and that's the critical issue. How much do they contribute to transmission in the community? And what can we do that's reasonable and flexible to minimize transmission from kids and get them back into school? And it's a very complicated process. The generalities that are being provided by the state health department are useful, but there are an enormous number of nitty-gritty decisions that have to be taken by a number of school districts on the fly. So we're working on it. It's pretty labor-intensive.
Well, and you could prepare for the best case or worst case scenario. As you said, it's the nitty-gritty, but it's going to be important for school districts to be what? Nimble? To be able to handle if there is a case? To be able to make a quick decision on whether to have more kids inside a school?
Yeah, I mean, especially how to handle an apparent case in the school. We're going to work out the issues of masking and social distancing and cohorting kids in classes. All those things we're working on. But the idea is that it is critically important for the kids' education, but it's also critically important for the parents and the economy to get kids back in school. And my biggest concern right now, the thing that keeps me up at night, is that what we've seen over the last 2 weeks is jeopardizing school reopening.
You've also been keeping a close eye on the science of coronavirus. We've been hearing that there is perhaps more than one strain, perhaps even three strains, one strain that was kind of specific to the Chicago area. Is this yet another huge problem as far as COVID-19 is concerned?
Absolutely not. It's interesting and not important to us. We have the virus circulating that we have circulating. It has its infectivity. Our failures are failures to maintain appropriate social distancing for long enough to build the infrastructure we need for testing and timely contact tracing. I think the viral mutations are fascinating. They're not what's driving what's going on. What's driving what's going on is failure to use the non-pharmaceutical interventions that are available. Social distancing, hand washing and masks. Stay home, right? Don't gather in large groups, especially inside. This is not rocket science at this point. There's a lot of very interesting rocket science going on about the virus. But that's not what should be informing our public health interventions at this point.
One other area is that people are kind of banking on a vaccine, kind of this cure-all silver bullet. Is that something that is just not even on the horizon as far as you're concerned?
It's not on the horizon until the first of the year at best. And we can't be going through these cycles of opening and closing till January 1. Yeah, I think a vaccine and progress in vaccines is really surprisingly good at this point in terms of the safety of a number of candidate vaccines and their ability to provoke an immune response. That's a long ways away from whether they're effective or not. And From my standpoint, it's not at the top of my list of the things to read every day. What's at the top of my list is the data on transmission by kids, especially, and on case reports, because the cases that we're counting, particularly the symptomatic cases, give us a window on how much transmission is occurring in the community. And right now, it is way too much. We believe it's being driven by reopening and young adults heading for bars and parties and those sorts of venues. And they're endangering the rest of the community.
I know you don't have a crystal ball and you don't like predicting in the future, but I would ask you anyhow, is that you're seeing this surge going on right now in late June, early July. Is this a taste of what could happen come this fall?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have our concerns that if we, things like school reopening, university reopening, community college reopening could drive surge. But the idea is not to put into place a lockdown forever. It's to put into place a lockdown that allows us to build and focus the capacity for testing and contact tracing, that we don't have to see a surge every time we change how we're approaching reopening. We need to be able to respond quite quickly, contact and identify and isolate contacts. And that's a very difficult thing to do. We did fine through May and June when we were seeing two or three cases a day in Scott County. Now we're seeing 30 and 40 cases a day, and it's hard to get control. If we can't find the contacts and ask them to get into isolation, they continue to spread. So this is about shoe leather public health, talking to people who have been contacts of cases and getting them into isolation before they spread. And the system is being stressed at this point. And I think probably contact tracing was my biggest concern in May, and I hate to be right, but it really looks to me like the availability of rapid turnaround testing in the appropriate populations, and then the ability to trace their contacts when they're positive, is that we have to build that capacity so that we don't go through these cycles, and I'm not sure we're there yet.
Our thanks to Dr. Lewis Katz, infectious disease specialist and medical director for the Scott County Health Department. In a moment, people infected with COVID-19 are now saving lives. That's still ahead. But first, the Census Bureau says it's now sending out workers to go door to door, visiting people who haven't filled out the 2020 census. The government says 70% of people in Scott County and 67% in Rock Island County filled out the form. Question is, will you soon get a knock on the door?
How will 2020 census data be used? Where there are more people, there are more needs for public services. That's why the census is used by the government to inform funding decisions each year. But that's not all. It's also used by nonprofits to inform services, by businesses to create jobs, and even by students for school projects. Understanding how the population changes helps us shape communities across the country for the better. Shape your future. Start here. Visit 2020census.gov.
There is a tried and true way to beat back many viruses. Collect the antibodies from the blood of people who have already recovered and use that as a vaccine that can prevent the virus or greatly lessen its impact on the body. Medical professionals around the world are gathering blood from COVID-19 patients in the hope that their antibodies can be that medical breakthrough. And part of that research is being done at the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center. We talked with Kirby Wynn at the Blood Center about the progress being made. Tell me what you're doing at the Blood Center that affects perhaps finding antibodies and perhaps that could lead to a vaccine for COVID-19.
Well, this is an opportunity for people to give plasma after they've recovered from a COVID-19 infection. And I've met a number of these folks and just have to say they're amazing. They've had this experience, this illness. Some of them got very sick, even hospitalized. And during that period of time, developed antibodies through their own immune system to the COVID-19 virus. And so following recovery, following, you know, kind of feeling better and symptoms have subsided and no longer contagious, those folks can actually make a plasma donation at our one of our donor centers. We're collecting all across our service region. And the plasma from these individuals can then be used as a treatment. It's called convalescent plasma. It can be used as a treatment for individuals who are, you know, currently fighting a COVID-19 infection. So, you know, it's only used for people who are themselves then are very sick and in the hospital and need something to boost their body's fight, you know, and production of their own antibodies to COVID-19.
And it's been proven to be effective for some people right now. We do know that. And you've been collecting since, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, April. I mean, what have you seen since April?
Mm-hmm. We may have even had our first donors at the end of March. I'm trying to remember when I met our first person. It was either the last week of March or the first of April. And, you know, it was a woman locally in the Quad Cities who actually spent several nights in a hospital. She and her husband both did. And she's authorized us to kind of talk about, or, you know, they both have said, yeah, we can kind of share a little bit about their story. They were very ill in rooms across the hall from each other. And they could communicate kind of by text message, but they said they were just both so tired. They were just trying to make it through the day each day, getting fluids and care like that from the, you know, nursing and doctors at the hospital. But when they recovered, and this is what's so amazing about these folks, I think, you know, they were very, very sick, but wanted to help and heard that they could give a plasma donation and make these antibodies available for other people, you know, who were in their shoes. But at the time, you know, especially early on, this treatment option wasn't available to them, but they made it available to others. And yeah, that started, you know, kind of early in our experience with COVID-19 in our region, either right at the end of March or 1st of April. And we've been building that donor base all across our service region ever since. And I mean, we've had donations made in St. Louis and in Madison, Wisconsin, in Cedar Rapids and the Quad Cities, of course, Springfield, Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. And so, you know, folks are out there who have to be referred into the program. You can't give this type of the convalescent plasma donation without having first had a positive test for COVID-19. And people can refer themselves into the program or their care provider. Even local public health has been helpful in helping us make these referrals and talk with people about the opportunity to give plasma and help out.
Those people who do donate blood at this point, I mean, do they automatically get tested for COVID-19?
They do not, no. A traditional whole blood donation is processed in all of the standard ways, but we are not testing widespread, you know, across all donation for COVID-19 antibodies. We are, though, under the convalescent plasma program, ensuring that antibodies are present in those plasma donations before we provide that unit out to a hospital, because that helps us ensure that's going to be a therapeutic dose of the plasma. But a widespread screening for antibodies is not taking place for our donors.
Summertime, always a tough time for the blood center and blood collection. I mean, people are out. They're not necessarily donating right now, but the need is still there. What is it like in 2020 in the era of COVID-19 as far as the area's blood supply is concerned?
You know, it's the blood drive cancellations that are the worst of it. Summer is always a challenging time, and you come through a summer holiday weekend, and it is just even more so. This year, we've had groups tell us, you know, we'd like to do our blood drive like we always have, but we've got employees, we've told them to work from home, and so nobody's here at the office, or we're on a very, you know, skeleton type of staff and can't schedule donors like we usually would for our blood drive. Or we might go to a large manufacturing site with a mobile unit, but the site has now established some policies about visitors to their facilities during the pandemic, and that would include impacts also our blood collection staff, and so they're not permitted to go on site for the blood drive. So we've lost, if you look from March out through August, All of the blood drive cancellations, including school blood drives, which are some large events, it's more than 20,000 donations that have been canceled or called off due to a blood drive cancellation. So it's had a big impact on the blood supply, but there's a good story here also, which is that donors are stepping forward to come to our donor centers, and they are keeping the donor centers busy and keeping the other mobile events that haven't been canceled also busy. And by busy, there are some caveats with that and some extra things we're doing to maintain, you know, safety of blood collection and generally a clean and hygienic environment to prevent COVID-19 spread. But, pardon me, the donation rate has kept up with patient need, but we are closer than ever before to that edge. And so ask everyone who could give blood to please come out, find an opportunity to donate.
Kirby Wynn of the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center. We understand you may have concerns about the coronavirus. For one thing, it seems like a never-ending black cloud hanging over all of us. It doesn't have to be that way. If you feel overwhelmed, reach out to the Robert Young Center or Unity Point Trinity Health in the Illinois Quad Cities or the Vera French Center and Genesis Health in the Iowa Quad Cities. The helplines are open now. They stay open 24/7. Or just type crisis hotline in Google to find a helping hand, a friendly voice, a safety net to get you through these difficult times. On the air, on the radio, on the web, and on your mobile device, thanks for taking some time to join us as we talk about the issues on the cities.
A proud supporter of this program, Riverbend Food Bank's vision is a hunger-free Iowa and Illinois.
Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory has been serving Quad City families since 1889. Whelan Presley Funeral Homes are located in Rock Island, Milan, and Reynolds and are proud supporters of WQPT.